This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hey, this is Ads from the Hump Day crew, and here's another one of our podcasts. Enjoy.
Peter Singer is an Australian philosopher. He is the Ira W. De Camp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, a Laureate Professor at the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics, University of Melbourne.
Specialising in applied ethics, after writing the book Animal Liberation, he is seen as one of the movers and shakers of the modern animal liberation movement.
He has written many books, including the titles Democracy and Disobedience, Should the Baby Live?, One World, The Ethics of Globalization, How Are We to Live?, and The President of Good and Evil, The Ethics of George W. Bush.
Now, I personally became aware of Peter Singer when a friend of mine lent me a copy of another of his titles, The Ethics of What We Eat. To talk to us now on this topic, we are joined by Peter Singer. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Adam. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, Peter, could you tell me why you decided to write the book, The Ethics of What We Eat?
Sure. Well, many years earlier, back in the early 90s, I teamed with Jim Mason, who's an American lawyer and environmentalist, to write a book called Animal Factories, which was about factory farming in the United States. And, you know, we were arguing that this is a bad trend, that it's bad for animals, bad for the environment, bad for people's health too. It didn't get a lot of traction, and we felt maybe in a way it was ahead of its time, because Americans' concerns and awareness about factory farming have just been starting to grow, you know, after the 2000 sort of those few years, people became more aware of it. A couple of animal organizations tried some referendums in some of the states that have referenda to get rid of some of the worst forms of factory farming, and they did surprisingly well. So we thought it would be a good idea to go back to that topic, but not just, you know, do another edition of the same book, but rather write a somewhat different book that would address the questions of what we eat and what the ethical aspects of that are, because it's not only factory farming, but that's obviously one of them. But we wanted to take a broad look at the ethical choices we make when we choose our food.
Now, looking at factory farming, something that maybe a lot of Australians might not be aware of is some of the shocking conditions that you covered in the book that pigs, cows, turkeys and chickens are kept in. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you found, I guess?
Yes, you're right. Unfortunately, there is still a lot of ignorance about how food is produced, and that's particularly intensively produced animal products. A lot of people still imagine that animals are generally free to wander around. I mean, they see perhaps cattle out on pasture, and cattle are still generally outside, that's true. But if we're talking about pigs and chickens, also laying hens, maybe turkeys as well, they're overwhelmingly kept indoors. You know, something like probably 98, 99% of chicken and pig production is indoors. They never get outside to walk around the fields. They're on bare concrete all the time. They don't even have straw to bed down in, because changing the straw adds to the costs, both the cost of the straw and the cleaning. So they're just on bare concrete, or sometimes they're on metal slats, whatever can be hosed down easily and cheaply, kept clean. In many cases, they can't stretch their limbs fully. The hens that lay eggs, for instance, in battery cages, the cages are too small for them to stretch their wings. In fact, even if there were just one hen per cage, they wouldn't be able to stretch their wings fully. But there's four, five, sometimes even six hens in one of those cages. The breeding sows that produce the pigs also spend most of their lives in stalls or crates so narrow that they can't turn around and they can't really walk at all. You know, maybe they can shuffle a step forward or backwards before they hit the end of the stall. And turkeys, you know, and chickens are also kept indoors. They do get to walk around. They're in a big shed, but they're incredibly crowded by the time they get fully grown and ready to be slaughtered. You know, they just cover the whole floor of the shed. When you look in, it looks like there's a white carpet, and that's because the birds are so densely packed.
Now, in the ethics of what we eat, you look at three American families and have a look at a lot of things that happen in America. Is Australia as bad as America?
It's pretty much the same. Certainly, the conditions I've been talking about for pigs and laying hens and chickens, they're pretty much the same. In fact, you know, California just voted to ban some of these practices, and I think it's about a five-year phase-out under the legislation. So in 5 years, things in Australia will actually be worse than they are in some states in the United States, like California. Our beef cattle are not quite so bad. We don't put them in feedlots for as long. They're a shorter period on feedlots, which is good because it means they're less wasteful of grain than they are in the United States. But that's really, I would say, the only one of these animal-producing industries that you could say is markedly better. Perhaps the dairy maybe is a little less intensive, but, you know, it's marginal. A lot of that is getting more intensive. So yeah, if you're talking about chickens, battery eggs, pig products, ham, bacon, pork, they're pretty much the same as the United States.
Peter, as well as a philosopher, I believe you're quite an activist, and it sounds like you're quite knowledgeable on this subject in particular. What have you been doing to fight against this, what sounds like, inhumane sort of food production?
Well, over the years, I've done quite a lot. Back in Australia, quite a few years ago, when Paul Keating was Prime Minister, I went into a farm that he was half owner of with a group of activists, and we chained ourselves to the stalls in front of the pigs. We went in at night, and at dawn we called the media, and we called the police too to complain about the conditions of the animals, just to publicise how you know tightly those animals were confined, how they couldn't really move around. So I've been into a few farms like that. More recently, I guess I've been spending more time in the United States because one of my positions is over there, and I've been supporting the moves to ban these practices. And because in the United States, about half of the states have a provision for referenda where the citizen can vote on something, I've been supporting organizations that have been trying to get this to a vote. And the really encouraging thing is that in every state where we've put to a vote the idea of banning some of these worst forms of confinement, we've won. So what that suggests is that if you can get people to vote on it directly, they don't like it. The problem is that federally, and this is true in Australia as well, I guess, certainly in the United States, both federally and in the states that don't have provision for a direct ballot, the money of the agribusiness lobby just overwhelms the views of the citizens. They just can't fight that influence, unfortunately. And so we don't get these things banned unless we can get everybody to vote on it.
One of the other interesting things I found about your book as well is you discussed a lot about the environmental impact of producing meat. Now, I know a lot of if you speak to people that aren't vegetarians on why they believe other people are, they normally go, oh, it's cruel to the animals. But the environmental impact's a big one as well, isn't it?
It is, and it's getting bigger every day, unfortunately, as the need to do something about climate change gets more urgent. And people are increasingly realising that animal agriculture is a huge contributor to climate change. In fact, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization said that it's bigger than transport, the greenhouse gas emissions from livestock worldwide. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the chair actually asked people to eat less meat because it's such a contributor to climate change. And this is true, you know, this is true both for factory farming where there's a huge waste of grain because we feed all this grain to animals and we waste most of the food value. But it's also true when we have cattle, whether beef cattle or dairy cattle, eating grass. Even if they're outside on pasture, that's better from the point of view of the lives of the animals. But unfortunately, their digestive systems just produce methane. That's a byproduct of breaking down the grass. And methane is an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas. And one of the most effective ways of slowing greenhouse gas emissions and slowing climate change would be to just eliminate the cattle and sheep because they're the ruminant animals that produce such a lot of methane.
As well as that, there is also the amount of waste that's produced by these animals, such as, I believe you said something along the lines of pigs produce four times as much waste as a human?
That's right, yeah. So you can have some of these big pig farms and they produce as much waste as an entire city. It's really quite amazing. And then you have this problem of what to do with it. In the United States, a lot of it is spread on the fields, but it's spread sometimes too thickly because they don't want to transport it far from the farm. So it runs off, gets into the river systems. Most of the U.S. River systems in the agricultural Midwest flow into the Mississippi. It flows down the Mississippi and contributes to the pollution of the rivers all the way down and contributes to this huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico where nothing can live in the water. You know, all the fish have all died because there's so much pollution in coming into the Gulf of Mexico through the Mississippi River.
Now, speaking of fish, I know a lot of people that refuse to eat maybe red meat and chicken, but they'll eat seafood. Is seafood any more ethical to eat?
Well, it depends, I'd say, on what kind of seafood you eat. If we're talking about fish, then there's basically two kinds of fish. There's farmed fish and there's wild caught fish. Farmed fish has the same problem as factory farming of chickens and pigs and so on, that you have to catch food, you have to get food and feed it to the animals because you're holding them, you know, caught in big nets. And unfortunately, the fish that we farm, like salmon, are carnivorous fish, and you have to catch twice as much fish out of the oceans and feed to them. So like 2 kilos you have to catch for every kilo of salmon you get out of it. So that's just scouring the oceans and causing more environmental degradation of the oceans. Now, when you go to wild-caught fish, if it's a sustainable fishery, you could argue that that's better than eating meat because it's, you know, got fewer greenhouse gas problems. The fish at least have a decent life. It's true that they die painfully because there's no humane slaughter in the fishing industry. But the problem is to know that it is a sustainable fishery. There's a few fisheries that have been certified by a body called the Marine Stewardship Council as okay, but you know, a lot of the fish that we're ripping out of the ocean, we're just doing it at an unsustainable rate. And if you look at the history of fishing for the last 50 years, going back to when the Newfoundland cod fishery was fished to commercial extinction, you know, it was one of the biggest schools of fish ever around, fisheries. There were just millions and millions of fish that had been caught for years, but once the big factory ships started coming in and scooping it all up, it's gone, and you know, it hasn't come back. It sort of went in the 60s and 70s, and it's not recovered. So that's happening to other fisheries as well. Things like orange roughy, which is a slow, long-lived, slow-breeding fish, is being fished to extinction. So you really have to know if you really want to say I'm prepared to be an ethical eater, but I think I'll continue to eat fish. You really need to study where the fish are coming from, and be sure that you're eating fish from a wild-caught sustainable fishery.
I think that you, I believe you concluded that it's more ethical to eat mussels and oysters and more of the mollusk.
Well, so certainly from the perspective of the animals, that is more ethical because, you know, fish are vertebrates. I'm convinced that they can feel pain. I don't think there's much doubt about that. And as I said, there is no humane slaughter in the fish industry. They die slowly and painfully, mostly of suffocation when they're hauled up out of the water. Whereas if you have things like mussels and oysters and scallops or clams, they're much simpler kind of organisms. I don't really believe that they can feel pain, so I'm not worried about that from that point of view. So I wouldn't really object to occasionally eating that, but you certainly wouldn't want to make it the basis of your diet, partly because they do accumulate heavy metals, and I think it's probably not recommended to eat them more than once a week.
Just out of interest, I was just having a thought there, moving on from fish and shellfish. What about globally in the different cultures and the different countries that eat certain foods? So, for example, horses in France, guinea pigs in Chile and Brazil and Bolivia, and maybe in Southeast Asian countries, rats, for example. What's your take on eating those types of food that aren't necessarily farmed, but they are from those countries?
Well, horses are farmed where they're eaten. I mean, if you go I was hiking in France a few years ago in the Pyrenees, and it was interesting to see these large herds of horses. And the first thought that we had is, oh, gee, must be a lot of people riding horses around here. And then, of course, you realize, well, no, it's just that they eat them, and it's just like seeing herds of cattle. It's just the same thing. So, you know, I think we often think, you know, we have our views that what we do is fine and what foreigners do is bad or wrong. But I honestly can't see a lot of difference between eating horses and eating cattle or pigs. You know, they're all animals. They're all capable of feeling pain. I'm sure they all suffer in the process. So I don't think anyone who's not a vegetarian can really be critical of people who are eating horse or, for that matter, you know, the other things you mentioned, guinea pigs, even dogs. I mean, the Koreans eat dogs and some of the Chinese do, and they're horribly mistreated. It's a dreadful industry. But is it so much worse than our intensive pig industry? I'm not really sure that it is.
Moving along from animals but staying on the ethical eating, talking about where we buy our food from, like even, for example, our rice, I've always assumed it would be better to buy locally. Like if I was buying rice, buy Australian rice. Is that the case?
No, I don't think it always is. I mean, I think there is a good argument for generally buying locally, and that argument is you reduce the carbon footprint because the food doesn't have to travel so far. And that's particularly true if you're talking about something that has been flown in. You know, if we're importing out-of-season cherries, you know, we're importing cherries from North America because it's out of season or something like that, they've been flown in because, you know, you can't ship cherries. They wouldn't be fresh and edible by the time they got there. So anything that you fly has a big carbon footprint. And yes, it's definitely better to say, well, look, I love cherries, but I'm going to wait until they're in season and eat the local ones. But if you're talking about something like rice, which has a long storage life, it doesn't have to be flown. It comes by ship. Ship is pretty efficient because, you know, a ship can carry a vast amount of cargo for not too much fossil fuel. And very often other countries are actually more efficient producers, more environmentally friendly producers than we are. So if you take rice, for example, say we get rice from Bangladesh where they grow it on the delta regions with the natural water that comes down from the rivers that rise in the Himalayas. And you compare that with Australian-grown rice, which is, you know, in a lot of trouble now anyway because of climate change and because rice needs a lot of water. And it's really pretty crazy for us to be growing rice in Australia given our water needs. So I would say that yes, it's environmentally better for us to take our rice from somewhere like Bangladesh. It's also, of course, you know, helps the peasant growers of Bangladesh who have a crop to sell and some export income, which they need. And to use our own water to get, you know, more flow into the Murray, perhaps, which we certainly need, or to use it for other urgent needs and not to do things like build this big desalination plant that the Victorian government is building down on the coast, which is going to be powered by burning coal and therefore just going to make the whole problem worse. So, yeah, I do think you shouldn't just automatically think local is better. Often local is better, but not every time.
It's done at the rule of thumb. Now, one thing I really liked in your book is that you acknowledge that people are busy and they have lives, and that some of the time we don't have the opportunity to research where every single bit of food comes from. Can we trust the labelling of the food when we go to the supermarket in Australia?
Generally, I think the labelling is trustworthy. Obviously, every now and again a scam will emerge. But I think that's definitely the exception, probably the fairly rare exception as far as I'm aware. I think we have reasonable certification schemes. You're thinking of things like certified organic, if you're thinking of country of origin labelling. Some of the country of origin labelling can be a bit misleading because it's a little, you know, things can be imported and put together and then get an Australian label when most ingredients come elsewhere. But as far as food's concerned, generally I think it's, you can't expect people to probe behind every label, and mostly I think they're right.
Now, you mentioned then organic food. I assume you're a fan of organic food?
Yes, I think that organic is definitely better. It's better on the environment. It's better for the long-term sustainability of our soils. We don't have the same pesticides and herbicides around. It's better for biodiversity in our own country. And, of course, it's better if you can support also smaller farmers. Now, organic can be get quite big as well, that's better. And where you have animal products, if they are labelled organic, that does mean that the animals are likely to have had better lives than the intensively farmed ones, because the organic label in Australia means that animals do have access to the outdoors. So that's certainly preferable to those that are conventionally produced where they don't have access to the outdoors.
Now, one good source of organic food in Melbourne, and you cover this in your book, was Macro Organic Whole Foods, which I've learnt they've just recently closed down.
I just heard that too, actually, and I was sorry to hear that. I'm not quite sure. I don't know the ins and outs of why that happened, because there's a big US chain called Whole Foods, which is very successful, and you know, it's got hundreds of stores across the United States. And I thought that Macro Whole Foods would grow to be the equivalent in Australia, but seems that's not to be.
Do you think Australia is embracing organic food enough, or do you think more work needs to be done?
Well, I think we are moving that direction. You can certainly find organics now in the mainstream supermarkets, which is a good thing, and I hope more people will be buying them. But people are also buying from local farmers' markets. You know, I tend to go to local farmers' markets when I'm in Australia. I go to the one in St Kilda that's on the first Saturday of every month, and there's quite a crowd there, and I know there's others all around town, so I think that's a good trend. People get more contact with their producers. So I hope that that continues as well.
But I think that the problem is the cost, unfortunately, that people are finding it easier to go to supermarkets, and also it tends to be a bit cheaper than the organic alternative, unfortunately.
It does. And that's a bigger difference in Australia than the United States, and that might be part of the problem, that they just have the volume there. So, I mean, organic is more expensive than conventional everywhere, but the difference is much greater here, it seems to me, than it is in the United States. So, and you know, the other option that I should mention here, though, you know, one way in which we're different from a lot of other countries is that a large proportion of Australians live in a home that has a bit of a garden around it, and I think it's great if people would think about growing a few of their own veggies, because most of us can do that. You know, we can produce our own organic stuff. We can enjoy watching it grow. And there's nothing better than something that you've just, you know, harvested half an hour before lunch, and you're eating absolutely fresh.
Yeah, so I remember back in when I was growing up in London, even we haven't got very big gardens, but my pop always used to have a veggie patch, and everything we ate around at Nan and Pop's was always grown from the garden.
That's right. Well, in England, they have this system of allotments, don't
yep.
they? Often,
yep.
often by the railway line or something like that, and people get a strip, and that's terrific. I've got friends in England who do that, and there are some opportunities to do that in Australia too, and I hope that they'll increase.
Yeah.
But I must admit, one of the things that I've been inspired to do after reading your book is I live in a unit that only has a balcony, but I've bought a few little planter pots, and we've
yep.
got little, you know, growing some strawberries and cherry tomatoes, and at least, you know, it's something. Wherever you live, you can still do something.
Absolutely, yeah. Most people can certainly go find room for a couple of pots and, you know, get some tomatoes, some herbs, strawberries, as you say. All of those things do well in pots.
I'm just the title I read out earlier, One World, The Ethics of Globalisation and the President of Good of Evil, The Ethics of George W. Bush. Sounds interesting. I must admit, I haven't read it at this stage, but it sounds, has that been received well?
Yes, both of those have done pretty well. One World, which came out just after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, has caused quite a lot of discussion and been used in quite a lot of courses. It talks about globalization in various forms. It talks about the WTO, and I try and take a reasonably balanced view of that. I think some people have been a bit, you know, polemical in attacking globalization, but there's no doubt that globalization has helped hundreds of millions of people to escape poverty, people in China and India, for example. So it has a good side as well as a bad side, but it needs to be properly controlled and regulated, I think, to make sure that the good side predominates. The book also talks about climate change and presents that as an ethical issue. And it talks about one world in the sense of one community where we can help people, where we can provide more assistance to the world's poor. And that's actually the theme also of my most recent book, which I think perhaps didn't get a mention in your introduction.
The Life You Can Save?
The Life You Can Save, that's right, yeah. Not sure if, I apologize if you did mention that.
But, no, I was going to lead into that though, Peter, trust
right.
me.
Okay. good, yeah. So, you know, I see all of these as aspects of globalization. So then the other book you mentioned was the one about George Bush, which, you know, I brought that out in 2004, just at the beginning of the year when he was up for re-election, and my hope or wish was that enough people would read it to realize what a disaster he was and that that would have some influence on the election. That was not to be, of course, and we had to survive another 4 years of him, but pretty soon people did realize how bad he was. And you know, well, I think we're just lucky that we survived 8 years of not only George W. Bush, but Dick Cheney and many years of Don Rumsfeld as well. I mean, you know, they produced many disasters, and of course, some people tragically didn't survive it. But we're in looking better nowadays, I guess.
Are you more of a supporter of Barack Obama?
I am. Yes, I think he's got very difficult challenges. Of course, you know, the global financial crisis, which was not his doing at all. But he's also got difficult challenges to. He will pull out of Iraq. That's clear, and that's the right move. He's still got problems in Afghanistan, where he said he does want to keep going. He's got big problems with healthcare reform and with climate change, both huge issues. He's got the right views, he's got the right ideas on both of them. In the United States system is different from ours. If you have a popular prime minister with a clear majority in parliament, basically they can get done what they want to do. But in the United States, the fact that you have a Democrat president and a Democratic majority in Congress doesn't mean necessarily that you can get things through, because the party discipline is much weaker. And, you know, we're seeing, for example, already on healthcare reform, quite a number of Democrats saying they won't vote for the kind of package that Obama wants, which I think is the right move, because, you know, the United States doesn't have universal healthcare coverage and it really needs to have it. But it's going to be tough politics to see whether Obama can get through on that, and on climate change too.
He made some pretty big calls recently with saying they'd reduce their targets would be 23% by 2020 and 80% by 2050. Do you think he'll have problems with them?
Nobody's going to worry too much about the 2050 target, because everybody's going to say, well, yeah, sure, you know, I'm not going to be around in 2050. You know, you guys may be around in 2050, but these are Congress people who are already in their 50s or 60s or whatever. They're not going to worry about targets for 2050 too much. But the 2020 target, you would have to get serious about doing something right now, and that's going to be the tough one, I think. I certainly hope you can pull it through, because it's desperately needed. I mean, that's a minimum that's needed, and of course he needs to get China and India to come on board as well to some extent.
Now, tell us a little bit more about your latest book, The Life The Life You Can Save.
Right. It's a continuation of ideas that I've been writing about over my entire career, which essentially starts off from the idea that there are children dying in the world who could be saved for rather small amounts of money, and yet we don't do it. And I compare this with seeing a child fall into a shallow pond and thinking, oh, well, I could save that child, but if I did, I'd ruin my nice clothes that I'm wearing, because I have to wade into that muddy water, so I'm not going to bother. And I think everybody would think that would be a monstrous thing to do if there was a child drowning in front of you. So somehow we just have to get over the fact that, you know, these children who are dying of diarrhea or malaria or measles or just malnutrition are not right in front of us. But they are there in the world, and we have agencies that are doing great work to try and help them and to reduce that death toll and to reduce poverty. But people are not doing anything much, or certainly not enough, to have the sort of impact that we could have. So I'm drawing attention to that. I'm trying to set a standard that people should think about giving to meet that standard, so they can feel that they've played their part in dealing with this terrible problem of world poverty, which is causing something like 18 million unnecessary deaths a year.
Wow. And there's also a website, thelifeyoucansave.com, that you can check out as well, that explains a bit more about the book as well.
Exactly, and about what you can do about the problem.
I think you make suggestions in one of your essays in the past as well for famine, affluence and morality about how we can actually donate part of our income to aid poverty and hopefully help out that way.
That's right, yes. And this book is a development of that article, and is setting some more specific targets that we might give to, in accordance with our income, a proportion of our income that we might give. Not too onerous, unless you're in the very wealthy category, and suggest some organisations, and the website does that as well, suggest some organisations you might give to. So I'm basically trying to make it easy for people and saying, well, you know, here it is, it's all laid out, now it's up to you.
Peter, we've discussed a lot of different things over this discussion on what people can do to make a difference in this world. If you could leave, I guess, one message to people that are listening, what message would you like to leave for them?
Well, I'd like to call on people to be a bit more reflective about, you know, what they're doing with their lives. We just have one life, and a lot of people kind of go through it just following a path that isn't really one that they've thought about too much, but they just, you know, doing the things that open up for them, the opportunities that open up for them. And I'd like to say, you know, stop and think about where you're going with your life, and do you want to make a difference to the world that you're living in, a positive difference? Do you want the world to be at least a slightly better place because you've lived? If so, then I think my books, both the ones about animals like Animal Liberation and The Ethics of What You Eat, and also the ones about world poverty like The Life You Can Save, give some suggestions about how you can make the world a better place.
Well, Peter Singer, it was an absolute pleasure reading one of your books, and I'm looking forward to reading many more of them, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
That's great. Thanks, Adam, and thanks also, Luke. It's been good speaking to you.
Hey, it's Ginny from the Hump Day Crew. If you haven't joined our Facebook group yet, while you're online, why don't you? Join the Hump Day Crew Facebook group. It's what all the cool kids are doing. We'll catch you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.